The views and opinions expressed by A Little Bit Culty are those of the hosts and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the podcast. Any content provided by our guests, bloggers, sponsors, or authors are of their opinion and are not intended to malign any religion, group, club, organization, business individual, anyone, or anything. Hey everyone, I'm Sarah Edmondson.
Hi, I'm Anthony Ames, Sarah's husband, aka Nippy.
And we're here to talk about things that are just a little bit culty. We were in a cult and we woke up, and it was all captured in a docuseries called The Vow on HBO, also in my memoir, Scarred.
And then we made this podcast. I guess you could say we're technically a cult show now.
But not your typical cult show. We're not so much about the grisly details. We are about kicking the doors down on the shame and the secrets that make these culty things so destructive.
We're here to have frank conversations about how cool things can cross over into the cultiverse. How to spot trouble when you see it, and what happens when it comes to recovering from something culty, if that happens to you.
Each week, we'll call on experts, advocates, fellow survivors, and whistleblowers to help us unpack what's going on in the cultiverse.
We're here to share what we know on everything from red flags to resiliency, and to have a few laughs along the way, because sometimes you gotta laugh.
Thank God. Now, we have a lot to cover, so let's get this show rolling, shall we? A Little Bit Culty Season 2 drops new episodes every Monday on the Acast app or wherever you get your podcasts. Be sure to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. And to learn more, visit us on Instagram or at alittlebitculty.com. Welcome back, everybody. Episode 2. Episode 1 dropped last week.
That's right. This is our first guest.
Episode 2. First guest of a lineup of incredible guests.
I know. Amanda Montell. The No-Tell Montell.
When I saw Amanda's book on Instagram, Cultish, before I even read it, I knew
that her first one's called Word Slut.
Word Slut. That is such a badass name for a book.
It's catchy.
As soon as I saw Cultish on Instagram, first of all, the cover drew me in, and then I saw some posts about what her book was about, and I was like, okay, she's going to be a guest. And then I read it, and I knew we had to have her on. I didn't know she was going to be the first one setting the stage for the rest of our season.
Yeah, but you know why for me? I mean, this loaded language thing is my thing right now. I'm seeing it everywhere. And when I read her book, I was like, this is going to be a good one.
Our guest today, Amanda Montell, argues in her book, Cultish, The Language of Fanaticism, that cults are more pervasive and everyday than we may think. And that language is at the root of all of it. She's an author, linguist, and fellow podcaster, and she joined us to talk about how cultish groups and social media gurus use language to manipulate followers and cultivate power. Here's our awesome conversation with Amanda Montell.
Amanda Montell.
We're going to start, actually, Amanda, with our opening from our mission statement from Nexium, which is at the end. Yeah, I'm surprising you with this, because I was like, we don't chant. We never chanted. But at the end, before every class, we would go in a huddle. We'd go, we are committed to our success.
That's Sarah, chant.
Stop it.
I know. It's
full blown a chant. Yeah, it may not have like a melody to it. It may not be in a foreign tongue, but that is a chant if I've ever heard one.
No. It for sure is. And the mission statement,
so
which I was looking to send to you, which I put, like I said, I put in storage for my own sanity. It took 5 minutes to go through. And it started with, Nippy, you want to do it with me real quick?
I'll never say those words again.
Well, I'll say it then. Success is an internal state of clear, honest knowledge of what I am, my value in the world, and my responsibility to the way I react to all things.
I'm going to throw up.
Isn't that gross when you think about what we know now?
Language is super triggering, you know, like. Everyone that I spoke to for the book told me that when they hear the words that they used to say in the wild, for whatever reason, whether it be because they encounter someone that they knew who was a part of the group from back in the day, or just because they used a word in a completely different way than normal everyday English speakers would use it, they would get like chills down their spine. It's so, I mean, it really just tingles a certain part of your brain that's really emotional and profound.
100%. But there's certain words to this day, like even the word success and goals is super loaded for both of us, or coach. It's just like really difficult. But first, welcome to our podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm a huge fan.
Well, I'm a huge fan. And especially like, you know, when we connected over the summer and exchanged books, I had no idea that your book was going to be so informative for us. I feel like we did a lot of our research for season two for our podcast with your book. So thank you.
Yeah, you did
research
for
us. Oh my gosh. I'm honored.
Yeah, it's true. And also I didn't realize how emotional it would be. And I hate to use a NXIVM word. I don't know what word it would be in real life, but I had a lot of integrations was a word from our cult, or awarenesses.
Mm-hmm.
Reading your book going, oh, like it brought a lot of things together for me in terms of like my own journey and why I got caught up in it and not in other things and how language played a part in that. So having you on our show kind of lays out the framework of a really key part of why we're doing our podcast, which is educating people as to how these things work. Specifically, what are the tools that hook people? And this episode will be about language because that's your expertise.
Yeah, that's such an important conversation because so many of the cult's documentaries and podcasts, so much of the sort of more sensational media coverage that you watch will explain cult affiliation, cult membership with vague talk of brainwashing. You know, I talk about this in the book, or some flimsy otherizing explanation of like, oh, they were mind controlled, they were desperate. But it became clear within the first few weeks of researching this book that, first of all, brainwashing is a myth. It's not a real or testable phenomenon. It is not enough to explain how this type of manipulation works. And the type of person that we've been conditioned to think is the person who would join a cult, someone desperate, naive, intellectually deficient, et cetera, is so not the case. Mm-hmm. And I had an inkling about that considering my own family history. But yeah, I mean, the research process and the writing process of this book was really illuminating and healing and an exercise in empathy for me as well.
Well, I just want to say, to steal your mom's phrase here, when I was, you know, getting ready to read your book, I was like, another cult book, you know, and I kind of felt, you know, here we go. And one of the things that I'm super sensitive to, you know, since going through our experience is the loading of language.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and Sarah can attest, every time I go, see, that's it. They're doing it. Even before I got your book, and like the first 50 pages were just, this is a page turner because you really hammer that home. And I'm like, oh my God, who is this girl? And I went back and looked at, you know, who is this person? How is she nailing this like this? And I said, let's just get her on her show, pull the ripcord, let her go and let her do her thing and have our podcast be a platform for really what you encapsulated, I think, in a lot of ways, taking complex concepts and simplifying them in a very cogent, intelligent way. So
thank
our
you.
Platform's yours
thank
and we're
you.
Just going to kind of guide it. But I think that's your acumen and I was very impressed with that. So
thank you. That really means a lot to me. Yeah. When I got my degree in linguistics in undergrad, I kind of just thought like, well, that was like a fun, useless thing that I studied that I'll sort of, you know, talk about at dinner parties, you know, why we talk the way we do, how language affects the way we move through the world. It was interesting to me. And it seemed interesting to everybody else that I would talk about it too, you know, just in everyday life. We all are interested in our speech and how it creates an identity and gives us access to power. Like I've always been interested in that. But when you hear the word linguistics, it can be kind of alienating. It sounds like something that would naturally be quite boring and dry, but I know from talking about it in the wild that it's really not. It's everybody uses language somehow, even nonverbal people. And we all want to know about the relationship between language and the way that we experience life. And so, yeah, my whole sort of crusade is to take linguistics from the high pedestal of academia and make it really accessible and fun and not that serious while also being reverent and well-researched for general readers. So thank you for really getting that.
Well, also language is the guardian at the gates, right? If you can develop a sensitivity to how language is being used, which it seems previous generations were more interested in, if you can bring that into the forefront for a younger generation so they can understand literally how we're being programmed, and it starts with language.
Oh yeah. Well, we take language for granted, right? Because it's invisible and it's seemingly harmless. Like sticks and stones can break your bones, but words will never hurt you or whatever. Yeah, but it really works really powerfully and invisibly to create our reality, you know, like without language, there are no beliefs, there is no community, there is no doctrine, there are no cults. So language has always been the lens through which I see the world. Who knows why? Some combination of nature, nurture, whatever made me this very like loquacious, language curious human being. And so, yeah, I've also always been interested in cults and cultish influence because of my dad, which I'm sure we'll talk about in a second. But the most interesting part of his stories to me was always the special language and the most interesting parts of human nature and human behavior and human community in general to me have always been the language as well.
So one thing that I really like about your perspective is that you're an expert, you're not a survivor of a cult, but you approach this with such a, in my experience of reading your book, such a like a curious, compassionate, non-judgmental perspective, which for us, you know, we're still dealing with leftover shame and self-judgment of the decisions that we made. So to read your book was actually very emotional for me to go through. I'm going to cry. Fuck, I was supposed to save this for the end. Damn it. Sorry.
Oh no, don't make me cry. I don't think I've ever cried on a podcast. Is today going to be the day?
It might be. I mean, I just felt like so much less alone, you know, and what we went through and for you to come from the perspective from not being a former cult member, because I think a lot of the us former cult members, there's a little bit of self-defense, like, no, smart people get involved too.
Of course.
You know, and you're coming from it, like I'm looking at this very objectively and what drives people to make those decisions in terms of language. So one of the things that we really want to do for our listeners is to be very specific. I don't want to give away your whole book in our podcast, but there's a couple of things we'd love for you to riff on. We're going to tie in a couple of things with Nexium and relate a few things, but we'd love for you just to explain some of the concepts that we found particularly interesting, specifically rubbernecking, loss aversion, toxic productivity dogma, prosperity gospels. We'll just throw some at you if we can.
Thought terminating cliches.
And we want to share some thought terminating cliches from Nexium just for fun.
It's all good.
It's all good. Is what it is.
Mm-hmm.
Just to go back to where we were with your dad, will you share with us a little bit about who your dad was and what drove you specifically to write this book? And we love the AA anecdote, if you don't mind resharing it.
Oh, sure. Yeah. So I grew up on these stories that my dad would tell of his childhood, which was fascinating and heartbreaking from start to finish. But the part of his stories that stuck out the most to me was the part from his teenage years, which he spent against his will in a pretty notorious cult called Synanon, which I sometimes describe as the Nexium of the 70s and early 80s, because it had kind of a lot of things in common. It wasn't exactly the same. Synanon started out as an alternative drug rehabilitation center for so-called dope fiends, but later grew to accommodate lifestylers or people who just wanted in on the blossoming countercultural movement of the 60s and 70s, another peak cult era in the United States like now. And my dad's dad, interesting guy, he was a card-carrying communist. He was a sort of pseudo-intellectual. He was my dad's like absentee father who left my dad and his single mom when my dad was very young. And when my dad was a teenager, 13 years old, he decided to move across the country away from his mom to try and find a better life and move in with his dad, who, of course, immediately moved my dad and his new replacement family, my dad's dad's new replacement family, including two little toddler age half sisters, onto this utopian compound in the Bay Area that was promised to provide solutions to the world's most urgent problems, addiction, classism, that sort of thing. It was promised to be this sort of socialist paradise. My dad showed up, and again, he was 14 and he had grown up until that point in Manhattan's School of Hard Knocks. And he got there, he's a skeptic and a pretty independent thinker. And he looked around and he was like, well, this seems like a cult. I don't know if the word cult was in his mind. This was 1969, the same year of the Manson family murders. And what a lot of people don't realize is that cults weren't really this widespread priority or symbol of fear in the United States. They really weren't on like the mainstream radar until about that time when the Manson family murders and then the Jonestown Massacre of 1978 put cults on the map as something that everyone should be aware of and that everyone should be terrified of. But in the late 60s, they weren't as infamous yet. So my dad showed up and he looked around and
he saw a lot of weird rituals and protocols and rules. Everybody really worshipped Synanon's charismatic leader, Chuck Diederich, on the level of a prophet. Kids had to live separate from their parents. Everybody had to shave their heads at a point. Couples were split up at a different point and assigned new Synanon marriages. No one was allowed to go to school or work on the outside. And everybody had to participate in this nightly ritual called the game, where people would be divided into circles and subjected to vicious interpersonal criticism by their peers. This was supposed to be a form of social therapy, but really it was a form of control. Yeah. So my dad really was quite disturbed by all of this. He laid really low. He escaped every single day to attend an outside high school so he could get a diploma and attend college. And he did all of those things. And well, now he's an acclaimed neuroscientist. So it really worked out well for him. He actually has one thing in common with a lot of the cult survivors and so many folks who wind up in these fanatical fringe groups. My dad is a skeptic and all those things, but he's also an extreme optimist. And this, more than desperation or naivety or anything, is, or how do you pronounce that word? Naivete. That is a word that, like, how do people even say that? I hear it pronounced so many ways, and it always sounds pretentious.
Yeah. It's like fiance. Yeah, my fiance.
These French loan words that kill you every time.
Laissez-faire.
Yes. Très chic. No, that's just French. Okay. But yes. So more than desperation or naivete or stupidity or anything, what I've found that a lot of the people who wind up in these groups share is this excess of idealism, this hope that answers to these really urgent problems can be found. And by affiliating with this group, they can be a part of that change. And my dad holds this extreme optimism too. And for him, it plays out in this real forward thinking. He's like full of hope. He's like, the past is the past. You know, Chuck Diederich, the founder of Synanon, is credited with the idiom, like, today is the first day of the rest of your life. You know, we've all heard that.
Oh,
he apparently came up with that. And, you know, of course, like all cults, and I'm using scare quotes because in my book, I talk about how that word is so subjective. And there's actually this cultish spectrum that a lot of different groups fall along. But yeah, like all cults have to have something positive to offer or else no one would join. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that sentiment was something really positive and something that my dad carries with him to this day. But my dad never thought to look back. He never thought to, you know, reflect on his cult experience, really, because he was just always looking ahead until I was born. And I, from an early age, was always demanding that my parents tell me stories. Tell me a story. Tell me a story. And I didn't want to hear a make-believe story. I wanted to hear a true story. And as it turned out, my dad had just this panoply of amazing true stories to share. I think this is what planted the seed of my love of nonfiction. Just the truth is stranger than fiction, y'all. And my dad's stories of his cult experience were just so enrapturing to me. And I think really, you know, honed my journalism skills from a young age, because I was like poking and prodding, like, what happened then? Why did this happen? And so I think my dad was kind of processing all that had happened to him by telling me those stories. But that's kind of the backstory. And then I grew up hearing the special language that Synanon used, because that was, of course, the most interesting part of it to me. Everywhere, not just in these sort of remote commune environments, but in the theater program that I was in high school, and the startup where I worked in my early 20s, and, you know, the way that my friends would talk about SoulCycle and CrossFit. I'm like, there is cultishness everywhere. And the proof is in the language. And there was so much, you know, special Synanon language that my dad would tell me about, you know, special terms, lifestylers, dope fiends, the game. Actually, I don't think I've told this story before, but I decided to join some like secret Facebook groups during my research process for Synanon survivors. And these Facebook groups require like an application, like not just anybody can join. They want them to be sort of safer spaces. And as I was applying to join one of these Synanon survivor and like families of Synanon survivor Facebook groups, the first question on the application was, name five pieces of Synanon jargon. That was like the key. That was like the passcode to tell if someone really knew Synanon or not. And I felt really validated by that, because I was like, oh yeah, this language of cults thing, there's something here.
So you got in.
I got in, yeah. And what goes on there shall go with me to my grave.
Excellent. Let me circle back to what you referenced in your book, the improper use of the subjective word cult. And I have a couple things I want to say about that. One is, I agree. We agree. Two, I don't know if we've talked about this in our podcast, but in our first 5-day, they taught us that people are going to say that we are a cult in Nexium. And
yeah, they gave us preemptive narratives to defend
how to deal with it. And what's true about it is actually kind of what you're saying is that it cuts people off at the knees and it's dismissive and it's saying generally it's bad without saying what's bad about it.
Exactly.
And, right? Which is totally true. And I remember Nancy Salzman saying, you know, if we were murdering people, they'd say we're murderers. If we were stealing, they'd say we're thieves. But by just saying it's a cult, it's not saying what's bad. What's bad? That is it bad to wear sashes? Like, what's bad about it? And when people would say we're in a cult, I mean, I got so good at deflecting that. I'd be like, yeah, I mean, sure, it's a cult. It's a group of people who we all think similarly, but it's a cult of happy, successful people. So what's bad?
Sure, sure.
We're happy. We're reaching our goals. Okay, I'm in a cult. And I guess
am
I shaving?
Defending it.
And even say things I didn't know this was from Synanon. Like, am I shaving my head? Nope. Am I drinking goat's blood? Nope. Am I wearing white robes? Nope. So what's bad about it? And to the point where, you know, when we blew the whistle and decided to expose it, we had to use the word cult because it's what people would understand to do what they needed to do to inspect it and investigate it and ultimately take it down. But it's still problematic. And one of the things I really got from your book is that I can't not use it anymore because also it's the title of our podcast, like with yours.
Of course.
But I also really, I want to be on part of this train with you of like shining light on, well, it's not really a good word because it's so hyperbolic and it doesn't allow for the nuances of what you do in your book to really understand there is a spectrum. And and as I was reading your book, I was like, oh God, I hope she's mentioned Stephen Hassan and his continuum.
Yep.
Right?
Yep. Yep.
Do you want to explain your understanding of that and how it shaped your analysis?
Of course. Well, I was hoping when I began writing the book that my understanding of the word cult would become clearer and more objective, but the opposite occurred. And I by no means think that we should stop using the word cult, you know, just because it can mean something totally different depending on the context, from, you know, a group with death and destruction involved to a makeup brand. You know, it can be used to describe these two polar opposites and everything in between. And that's not necessarily bad because language doesn't have meaning without context. And you're right, the word cult can evoke a certain level of stakes for people. And it causes them to really pay attention. Whereas these softer, more academically accepted terms like new religious movement and fringe religion, alternative religion, which are more like politically correct and non-judgmental, they're not going to get that attention. And when you're trying to expose an abusive group, that's not necessarily the time for this like labeling conversation, you know?
Right. Right.
But yeah, I mean, it's interesting, like the origins and etymology and evolution of the word cults really corresponds to our culture's relationship to community and spirituality and identity and meaning. And that relationship in the United States in particular has always been really fraught. So the word cult didn't always have these really sinister connotations in its earliest iteration, which was centuries ago. It simply meant offerings made to win over the gods or homage to divinity. And then it evolved, you know, in the 1800s to mean a sort of churchly classification along religion and sect. It didn't really gain its sort of more, you know, its darker meaning until the era known as the Fourth Great Awakening, which was this peak new religious movement era in the mid 20th century, 50s, 60s, 70s, when new religions like everything from the Church of Aphrodite to Jews for Jesus started spooking old school conservatives and Christians. And so at that point, cult gained this reputation of, you know, these are quacks, these are kooks, these are charlatans, these are heretics. And then it wasn't until, as I mentioned, the Manson family.
Would you say that's when the abuses started becoming evident? And then the moniker, because there's a deficit of language around these kind of things, would you say that the abuses were evident and then it adopted the cult moniker as it kind of has today? Or what would be the reason for that?
I don't think so, because you know, what mainstream religion doesn't have blood on their hands or hasn't been guilty of abuse? Right. Like, the word cult has been used to describe so many what are now accepted religions in our culture, right? From Catholics mm-hmm. to Quakers, mm-hmm. which are just about the chillest religious people ever. So I think American Protestants were just disturbed by the mm-hmm. formation of these new religious movements, some of which were abusive and some of which weren't, some of which had like a net positive effect, some of which were mostly sure. truly harmless. So I think cult at that point became this judgment, or started to. And then okay. once the Manson family murders and the Jonestown massacre happened, everybody knew what a cult was, and it was something to hate, and it was something to lambast. And ever since then, it's been used as this harsh judgment. You're in a cult. No, you're in a cult. But it's not necessarily specific enough to be able right. to determine what those dangers on the table are. As you know, you were trained right. to say like, oh, we're not a cult because we don't shave our heads. We're not a cult because we're not wearing white robes. But that's just the problem, is that sometimes a cult doesn't look like this Midsommar-esque compound. Sometimes sure. it looks like a perfectly innocuous self-help seminar. And that's something mm-hmm. that I hope to communicate in the book, is that none of us are immune to cultish influence. Cults don't always look as you think they're supposed to. The word cult is so sensational and so subjective that you really need to look deeper and have your antenna up a slightly more sensitive way to be able to figure out, like, is this group actually harmful? And if so, in what way?
Right. And I think, to underscore your point, a lot of people like to think they're immune to these things.
I think we should just give them Amanda's
language,
book.
Yeah, just with the language that they use. And our first module was called Rules and Rituals, right? And it went over kind of what I would perceive as innocuous kind of things about, like,
take, you know, our shoes
what
off.
We're going to do to establish, shoes off, community stuff like that. And I've always maintained, if you were to put 1,000 people on an island, in about 48 hours, you would have some rules and rituals in place just by people's skill sets, just because we need to establish these rules and rituals so we can survive on the island. Tribalism, used well and responsibly, ensures our survival. Just read your history books.
100%.
Right? One of the things I like about your book is that you develop kind of a template where people can be sensitive to when these tribalistic groups become abusive, right?
And that's right.
What do you think that point is? I kind of have my experience, but, you know, it was my experience and your objective mm-hmm. coming into it, which is what I love. You're not exactly someone who went through an experience. So objectively, when you looked into these groups, what is it that you found was ding, ding, this is when it goes bad.
Get this the fuck
is when,
out.
This is when pack your bags, right. tell your mom and dad they were right, and
yeah,
hit the bricks.
First, I'll say that I'm objective-ish.
Yeah, I understand.
I mean, we all have our bias, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I'm coming in as an outsider, as sort of a journalist with a personal connection to the subject matter. But yeah, I mean, that's the other thing about the word cult, is that scholars and, you know, everyday people have tried to come up with lists of criteria for what makes something a cult, or as I might call it, a group on the destructive end of the cultish spectrum. It's kind of a cumbersome way of saying it, but, you know, things like an us versus them mentality and justify the means philosophy, supernatural beliefs, a charismatic leader. You know, people have come up with all these boxes that you have to check off. But the tricky part is that not every group that has been or could be called a cult will check off every box.
Sure.
And yet so many mainstream groups, from, you know, traditional religions to government bodies to Silicon Valley companies, mm-hmm. will check off every single box. So it is really tricky. I want to go back really quickly to you asked about my AA anecdote. Mm-hmm. And I want to use that to illustrate that, like, I don't think all cultish groups are inherently bad, as you're saying.
Right.
Like, tribalism and community and connection, these are profoundly human drives. Our ancient ancestors participated in group rituals, dances, chants in their village squares, even though there was no, like, survival need to do that, because it just feels good. It feels really human to want to engage in a transcendent experience with other people having the same experience. And I don't think we should push against that necessarily. And the AA anecdote is, you know, the idea for this book, to write about the language of cults, snapped into focus for me in early 2017 when I was talking to a friend of mine who had just gotten sober and started going to AA. This is my best friend. Like, she and I can communicate without speaking at all. And all of a sudden she was talking to me with all of these like really culty sounding AA buzzwords, which were really catchy. You know, she was saying things like halting and caught a resentment, like AA for those who know anyone who's in the program. Like it has this really robust glossary of super zingy, like catchphrases and slogans and acronyms and such. And I was like, whoa, like that is some culty sounding language there. And she was like, oh, I know it's super culty, but it really helps me stay sober. She was like, it keeps me going. It helps me like establish that sense of solidarity and connection. And so that seemed like a form of cultish language that was there for a net positive reason with, you know, it was like eerily conformist, but ultimately was really helping a lot of people. And so I don't think that cultish language necessarily has to be bad. A lot of groups use it in a way that is not, you know, nefarious and abusive. As I've been saying this whole time, like I hear the world with language. Like that's the way that I see people and identities. And so for me, like when a group checks off these different linguistic boxes, these different techniques of cultish language that I lay out in the book, once you check off more and more boxes, it starts to sound more and more abusive. And like anything in life, like there's no good cult, bad cult binary. It is this spectrum. It's like, okay, you have some special buzzwords and mantras and such. It's culty, but maybe it's not so bad.
Right.
Then once you start to get the loaded language and the us them labels to establish insiders and outsiders, and then the thought terminating cliches and the charged euphemisms that are there to obscure truths and encourage conformity and discourage independent thinking. Like once you check off those linguistic boxes, then that's a clue. Okay, this group might be a little too cultish for comfort. And we can talk more about what those precise linguistic features that I just mentioned mean. But certainly from the start, Nexium seemed to have a lot of them. But of course, like you were saying in the beginning, module one, you know, that's easy to get on board with. You take off your shoes, you do this, you do that. Like nobody is leading with, you know, like the most destructive, hard to get on board with stuff. Like nobody is leading with DOS or whatever.
Right. No one said on day one, and in 12 right. years, you're going to have the cult leader's initials seared into your flesh.
Exactly. Because
Thank
then
you,
nobody
Vanguard.
would ever join.
Wouldn't you say that's the initial abuse though, right? Like someone who
like
understands language, right?
Let's say
you understand language very, very well. And let's say you had bad intent. I'm pretty sure you could come up with how language would be innocuous, bland, even boring at a certain point to get people in. And then at a certain point, you would know when to go, okay, here's where I'm going to do my game, right? And you understand that language as well.
Mm.
So I think the initial abuse came with putting us to sleep with, oh, I can get on board with that. That's silly and corny and whatever. But that to me is the initial abuse because you're in a lot of ways agreeing to something benign up front, and then the language slowly starts to go. And to your point with the AA, you know, I remember coming home. If you know anything about my family, I'm one of four boys, and it's Cynics headquarters, right?
Uh-huh.
So when I came back, and I was using words like goals and you know, well, why don't you just go out and get the data on where you're good at? My brother was like, "The fuck are you talking about?
Get the data."
Wait, what is that shit? And I was like, oh, I knew not. They were training me not to use that language around them, right? But I even had friends who were like, what is get the data? Is that your cult?
Here's the thing. We as human beings, we love a secret code language. We really do. I mean, I don't know if you like spoke pig Latin on the playground as a little kid, but
right.
I did. And you were just filled with this instant sense of superiority.
Yes.
Once
yes.
you learned how to speak
yes.
this special language,
yes.
like we really crave that. It feels like a snazzy new uniform. It's like, I'm good at something. Like I'm on the right track because I know
right.
how to use this language. And you're like dispelling another myth here where it's like, you know, this myth of brainwashing says that you can mind control someone to believe anything with some sort of like system of magic techniques. But it's like, no, you can't do that. You can only give someone license to believe what they already want to believe on some level. You can only sort of like
take advantage of their willingness and their openness to want to believe this thing. And who doesn't want to believe that their success is possible or that they can achieve a more heightened version of themselves? Mm-hmm. And even you had like skeptical family members around you being like, what the fuck are you talking about? But like, you wanted to believe it. A lot of us do. And it takes a certain amount of optimism and dreaminess to want to believe that. And the language can really help get you there. And I think what you're getting at where it's like, it's the first level of deception leading with the sort of most innocuous, softest labels and ideology. It reminds me so much of Scientology, a huge inspiration for Nexium was, you know, the first Scientology courses are called things like communication, like things that anybody could get on board with.
Ours too. Module, communication and the cause.
It sounds so something basic that anybody would learn how to do better. Just, it's plain English. This speaks a little bit to the love bombing aspect, you know, this idea that you're showering someone with attention and with promises to make them feel like inspired, like, oh, hell yeah, like I can get on board with like this new community of people that want to make me a better self. And then, of course, that love bombing is soon exchanged for control, and gaslighting comes into play and other kinds of conditioning and coercion come into play. But at first you're filled with inspiration because the language that you're using, special as it is, isn't really communicating what's lying underneath. It's Correct. It's obscuring it. And that's a big part of the deception that you're talking about.
When you said snazzy new outfit, I all of a sudden remembered at a flashback too. I don't think we've ever talked about this. When I was in grade 2, I really wanted to become a brownie. Do you know what the brownies are? Like,
there's of course.
Right. Yeah. So I wanted to be a brownie, not because I wanted to learn how to like make fires and like collect. I don't know. I don't even know what you did.
Oh,
in the
my
brownies.
God. So funny. Brownies are like the little girl's first cult.
Yeah.
Baby's first cult.
Totally. But I wanted to join because I liked the outfits. I wanted the little brown dress and the orange sash that they wore. So I wanted 70s. That. And I wanted to be part of that. See? And this is like part of why
the
I really
cookies.
Loved your book. It wasn't the cookies. It was the outfit.
Ten men from the Samoas? You kidding
but like,
me?
I love
They're cute.
It kind of like pulled everything together of my cultish journey. And it's not just with Nexium. I have a lot of brushes with other groups. And I'm always wondered, why didn't I get pulled into a yoga group? And for some reason, like I had lots of friends that did the Kundalini thing. And I couldn't get my head around the white and the turbans. But somehow, like I was like, why are sashes okay? And turban's not okay for me. Like, why was that a red flag? And I think largely a lot of the things that were problematic, the red flag issues for me with Nexium, were always trumped by the fact that I had somebody who invited me who I really trusted, right? And was saying, overlook that. It's going to all make sense. You know, I know sashes are weird, and it was true. By the end, it was like, oh, this sash means so much to me. It's what I've earned and it's an indication of my growth. And I loved it. Mm-hmm. But I went from being like, I'm not wearing that to, oh, this is so meaningful.
Right.
Was it what we were talking about the other day? Like, how can we be in one occult and we look at all the other stuff and we see right through it? Remember we were talking about that?
Yes. Isn't that so interesting? No, I mean, but that's something,
that's
something that I wanted to mean. It's so fascinating.
Like,
and like, I've done it too.
Bullshit.
Completely. I mean, I've done it too. Like when I think about my own cultish affiliations, my extremely codependent relationship with social media, I used to work in the beauty industry where I was conforming so hard to these really quite predatory standards and practices. Mm-hmm. I talk about in the book how an abusive one-on-one relationship is really just a cult of one. And I've been in my fair share of those with partners and friends and bosses. You know, those techniques of manipulation are really similar. They're called something different. You know, in a relationship, it's called grooming. In a cult, it's called brainwashing. You know, abusive lovers are called these charming narcissists, whereas cult leaders are called charismatic gurus. Like the labeling is different, but the sort of techniques of conditioning, coercion, et cetera, are more or less the same. And that was an extremely humbling discovery because it's like, oh, I, as someone who's this like lifelong skeptic, oh, I would never fall prey to the charms of, you know, a power abusive megalomaniac. It's like, oh, no, I have. It's just not in the context of, wearing a turban. I think, too, like the media probably plays a huge role, media coverage, movies, documentaries, in what we think of as a cult. And that plays into some of the defenses that you were taught to give. It's like, oh, we're not shaving our heads, et cetera.
Can you define for our audience what a thought terminating cliche is so we can dig in on that?
Of course. So this is one of the elements of cultish language that I talk about in the book. And it's the sort of thing where once
you... Page 85, by the way.
Page 85. Wow. I believe it. Yeah. It's the sort of thing where once you understand what it is, you won't be able to unhear it. Thought terminating cliches. So this was a term that was coined in the early 60s by a psychologist named Robert J. Lifton and describes a sort of stock expression that's easily memorized, easily repeated, and aimed at shutting down independent thinking or questioning. So questioning, obviously, is the enemy to any cultish group. And so a leader is going to need a roster of phrases to silence or shut down a person whenever they want to express dissent.
Our team at A Little Bit Culty Podcasts loves the Blood Ties podcast because it is gritty and current and fascinating. It's also a little bit culty. Blood Ties, the award-winning audio drama from Wondery, returns for its third season, Strange Days, with another thrilling story about greed, power, and deception. 5 years have passed since Eleanor, played by Julian Jacobs of Community, took over as CEO of the infamous Richland family empire, alongside her half-brother, Santino, played by Christian Navarro of 13 Reasons Why. Together, they decide to invest the family fortune in a groundbreaking, controversial new drug. But as shocking revelations about the new treatment emerge, Eleanor and Santino go to every length to protect their control of the Richland family dynasty. As Eleanor's father always said, medicine is a bloody business. Listen to Blood Ties, Season 3, Strange Days, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Spotify, or you can binge the whole series now, early and ad-free, by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app. Did anyone learn a language in high school and then let it go and then have regrets about that later? If you're anything like me, then maybe you'll relate. I did French all the way up into 12th grade, and then I let it go. I mean, I lived in Montreal for a few years and, you know, practiced a bit, but it just slipped away. And then I found Babbel. Babbel is the language learning app that sold more than 10 million subscriptions. And thanks to Babbel's addictively fun and easy little bite-sized language lessons, I've been able to get back my French. I've actually found learning French to be fun again. And c'est vrai, je parle français. With Babbel, you only need 10 minutes to complete a lesson, so you can start having real-life conversations in a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Other language learning apps use AI for their lesson plans, but Babbel lessons were created by over 150 language experts and voiced by real native speakers, not computers. Their teaching method has been scientifically proven to be effective. And with Babbel, you can choose from 14 different languages, including Spanish, French, Italian, and German. Formidable. That means wonderful in French. Plus, Babbel's speech recognition technology helps you to improve your pronunciation and accent. Clearly still working on that. There are so many ways to learn with Babbel. In addition to lessons, you can access podcasts, games, videos, stories, and even live classes. Plus, it comes with a 20-day money-back guarantee. Start your new language learning journey today with Babbel. Right now, when you purchase a 3-month Babbel subscription, you'll get an additional 3 months for free. That's 6 months for the price of three. Just go to babbel.com and use promo code CULTY. That's BABBEL.com, code CULTY.
So in Synanon, the group that my dad was in, a thought-terminating cliche that was used a lot was this phrase, act as if. And it was something, it was this imperative that you would be served whenever you wanted to push back. It's like, you know, everyone is so tired tonight. Do we have to do the game tonight? Or, you know, my sister like is really interested in this one subject that's not taught at the Synanon school. Couldn't she go off campus and learn it somewhere else? Like whenever you wanted to break one of Synanon's rules or you didn't understand why something was happening there the way it was, someone would say, oh, act as if. And it meant act as if you believe in this protocol until you do, because Chuck Dietrich, the leader, he's all-knowing. He's much smarter and wiser than all of us. And trust me, he's right about this. So act as if you believe in Chuck's rules, and eventually you will. So act as if was thrown around right and left. And, you know, when I was watching The Vow, I like immediately seized whenever I would hear a phrase like, you know, well, don't let yourself be ruled by fear, or dismissing some kind of valid anxiety or doubt as a limiting belief
That's a classic thought terminating cliche. And they're really useful. They're really compelling because they alleviate cognitive dissonance temporarily, or that uncomfortable discord you feel when you hold two conflicting ideas in your mind at the same time. It's really work to think, to have to like reconcile your skepticism and your fear about this thing that you want to believe in so badly. And it's a relief not to have to. So when you have a question again, or want to express some kind of dissent, and somebody serves you with one of these really, you know, catchy stock expressions, you get to kind of relax for a while. And thought terminating cliches also show up in our everyday lives. You mentioned one earlier. It is what it is. Boys will be boys. Everything happens for a reason. And when a cultish group has too many of these, and they are used really frequently, anytime someone has any form of skepticism to express, that's a huge red flag. You know, Stephen Hassan, who was one of my first interviews for my book, said to me, anything legitimate will stand up to scrutiny, any group at all. So whether you're working at a startup or you're, you know, a member of a certain church or whatever, you should be able to ask questions. And if you're hit with a thought terminating cliche every time, again, that's a sign that this group might not be so healthy for you.
We actually wrote a list of, like, just off the top of our head of a few. Can we read them
to
you? Oh,
goody. I would love to hear them. Yes, please.
I hear Nancy's voice going, what's going on for you that you're bringing that up right now? That'd be one.
It's just a viscera.
Just a viscera. So we talked about how, like, the visceral reactions we had is just a viscera. It doesn't mean it's actually something to be concerned about. You're just having a visceral reaction, which was parallel to, you seem reactive. Mm. Have you talked to your coach about that? Mm. How does that relate to your life issue? Why don't you journal on it? How did you cause that?
It's mini gaslighting. It's like, well, I can gaslight you in a little sentence. There's some things, and Sarah and I, when we saw The Vow, we were shocked at some of the stuff that we were seeing. There was one that I paused and I was like, did he just fucking say that? He's like, if it's true for you, therefore it must be somewhat true. And I was like, what the fuck? Like, you know, who says that shit?
Yeah.
So he was, but he had, like, he had certain people.
He was a master.
Like, totally. I mean, some of those really remind me of a thought terminating cliche that was used a lot in Shambhala Buddhism, which is another cultish group that I talk about in the book. People sometimes ask me, like, how did you meet all your sources? You know, I conducted, you know, dozens and dozens of interviews with cult survivors, cultish survivors. People are like, how did you meet them? I'm like, I live in LA, baby. You can't go to a birthday party without running into someone who was in some kind of cult. And truly, my Shambhala Buddhism source, I met at a party in my boyfriend's old roommate's house. And I sat down with her the next day and conducted this 2-hour interview. And she was telling me about how, you know, she lived on this sort of pseudo Buddhist compound that ended up being pretty predatory and abusive, and was the subject of a New York Times expose, as is so often the case. And their thought terminating cliche that used a lot is, why don't you sit with that? And it was a bastardization of a key Buddhist teaching, which says to drive all blames into one. And I won't get into the Buddhist philosophy, but what I hear in Nexium language, which is what I hear in a lot of sort of new agey groups, Scientology, so many of these new age spiritual cults on social media, is that they combine the language of therapy, of the DSM. So, you'll talk about, like, journaling, or even, you know, you'll talk of actual mental health diagnoses like borderline or bipolar or anxiety. You'll use a sort of mental health language. You'll combine it with this sort of mystical, magical language, talk of like Akashic records or like vibrations or frequencies or paradigm shifts, awakening, enlightenment. And you'll combine that with science language, technical jargon from fields like physics, software engineering,
data,
exactly. And this creates the impression that you are tapped into an authority higher than science. Like, if you can combine terminology from astrophysics, the DSM, and New Age spirituality, you create the impression that you are incredibly wise. You have this transcendent wisdom. You have expertise in all of these different fields. And doesn't matter if you're completely misusing this jargon. I mean, so much of Scientology jargon was co-opted from, like,
if people have watched Scientology documentaries, you'll recognize terms like engram and valence. Like these are terms from scientific fields that have really precise meanings that help communication become easier and more succinct. But in Scientology, they made communication vaguer, and they really were used as these shibboleths to divide people into an us and a them, to shut people down, to make people feel stupid, or to make people feel supercilious if they knew how to use the language. So yeah, there's definitely a difference between like technical jargon and cultish language. But that's what I'm hearing in Nexium. It combined the language of so many different areas to create this next level wisdom that was actually kind of empty at the end of the day.
So just to take what you just said and add to it, because it was all those things. It was therapy, and it was, it said it wasn't new age, but it was. Like they specifically said, you know, woo-woo stuff can't be measured. This is science-based, but there was an emphasis in sort of like a, like the, there's a Buddhist element to it. Like happiness is an inside job and nothing from the outside world will ever fill that void, which is, you know, there's some truth in that. So it was this mystical and spiritual and science-based. And it was also, even though they said they weren't, it was also an MLM.
Oh, yeah. Oh, this is my favorite part about it.
Right?
Favorite.
Yeah. Well, let's go. Right. Well, that's the thing, is they specifically said it wasn't an MLM because, quote, MLMs are unethical inherently, and this is ethical.
I love how I see this so much. I see this so much. Like, someone will say things like, oh, I wouldn't be a therapist if I were unethical. Like, it's like, what? That doesn't make sense. MLMs will say this can't be a pyramid scheme. Pyramid schemes are illegal, as if just because something is illegal means you aren't doing it. Like, even if you didn't, it makes no sense. It's like, I mean, before marijuana was legal, I was still smoking it. Like something can still exist, and you can still be doing it even if it's illegal. You can even be doing it without the knowledge that that thing is illegal. You like, just naming something as ethical doesn't make
it
ethical.
Oh,
for sure. I mean, it's this campaign to make you mistrust your reality. Like, people use the word gaslighting so willy-nilly on the internet. Like, it has completely lost its meaning in some ways. But
yeah.
I think people just use it to mean like lying or like mistreating other people in literally any type of way. But gaslighting, for the record, is this campaign to, you know, manipulate someone into mistrusting and questioning their own valid experiences, feelings, beliefs, and language completely is how that happens.
Amanda, I think you'll get a kick out of this. Once the authorities were involved and Keith was on trial, there was still, and there still are to this day, a small handful of loyalists that were holding on and trying to show the truth about Keith and how misunderstood he was and how, in fact, it was the prosecution process that was unethical, right? And when he was accused of these bad things, we heard that there was one particular person who was leading the charge and trying to rally people to come back into the fold and was saying to them, well, just because it's illegal, it doesn't mean it's bad. So just because Keith was being charged with illegal things,
I mean,
and citing things like marijuana, like there was a time when it was illegal and it wasn't bad. So just because Keith had underage sex, does that mean it's bad? And that's what ultimate gaslighting of the former members, to say like, well, okay, it's true, he's been brought to court for these things, but does it make it bad? Like, have you had like the ultimate gaslighting, using language to have people question?
Because he would play these like logic games.
Yes.
That really weren't like valid puzzles. They just like sounded really good, but didn't mean anything. Like, I was recently looking at Keith Raniere quotes for like an exercise that I do on my podcast. And there was this one quote that I read. Oh God, what was it? It was like something along the lines. It was trying to do a sort of JFK thing, like, ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. It was like trying to do something like that, but it was like, you know, you can't have the fortitude to like know what you're doing unless you can do what you know. It was like something like that. And it made no sense. It sounded really good though.
I have a whole imitation of him that I did.
At Nancy's birthday.
I would love to.
And it's just verbal diarrhea.
Yes.
I was just pissing on him.
He was so good at that sort of like mind fuck of like saying something that sounds really sweet, but it like
contort it. It's like trying to play a logic game.
Pick a subject matter. I'll do one.
Okay.
Pick something.
Let's do food.
It's interesting. You look at food, and while it may nurture you in the physical level, one might also say that it can nurture you in the spiritual level. And those two things in conjunction can lead to an all-knowing, encompassing thing about what it is that we call food. and you're like, what the fuck? Like, you're like, what? Like, just take a fucking bite and move on with it.
That reminds me so much of that like kid in school who would raise their hand after the teacher asked a question. And they didn't know what they were about to say, but they just wanted to sort of like experiment with hearing their own voice. And like, we never know. This is the amazing thing about the human mind. We never know what we're going to say when we open our mouths. Like, in a way, we don't have free will. Like, I open my mouth and I don't know what the fuck is going to come out. And it's amazing that we ever say anything that makes any sense, but it takes someone with a certain amount of hubris and megalomania to open their mouths on a stage on any topic and like wax authoritative on it in the way that he did.
That's why I think anyone who runs for president has a fucking
1,000%. I agree with you. I completely agree.
I think, why the fuck would you want that job?
And people, you know, this is so funny. Talking about social media and stuff.
And what makes you think you're going to do something better than
I'm so with you. I'm so with you.
People come before you, and like, I think that's the blinking light.
You're so right. We were talking about social media before, and it's like, you know, we all again are being incentivized to create our own mini cults on Instagram, etc. And anytime, this has only happened a couple times, when someone has sort of like in earnest accused me of like building my own little cult on Instagram or whatever, it's funny because like the second you start to defend why you're not a cult leader, you immediately sound like one. Also, it's just like, honey, I am too lazy. I am too like, I like to sleep too much. And I don't, I just don't have what it takes to like start to run for president or start a cult or any of that. It's just like, I just want to be left alone.
But that whole exchange you just had, I had a question from your book. That we call that word salad. I would wonder if that's a term that you use, because I didn't hear it in your book or I didn't read it. Is that something
I didn't talk about
in your linguistic
word salad? I mean, in linguistics, like during my studies of linguistics, I would hear word salad in the context. I think there's a technical term for it that that's escaping me. There is a technical linguistic term for word salad, but it applies to when someone has like a brain injury that affects the part of their brain responsible for
aphasia.
It's something like that. And then like they
have a stroke.
Yeah, exactly. Or like a car crash or something. And yeah, aphasia or apraxia. I forget. Oh my gosh. My linguistics professors would be so disappointed. But I know what you're saying. You'll sort of take like a grab bag of terms that don't really mean anything when you put them all together in that way, but create this impression of authority. I mean, it's kind of like what Trump would do. Like he just had this roster of loaded buzzwords that he would rely on and mix and match. And it wasn't even about what he was saying. It was about the delivery and about what the audience wanted to hear.
Just going back also to the MLM thing, which we didn't really finish. That was what pulled for me your whole book together, different concepts that I hadn't recognized their historical background in terms of MLMs, Christianity, the prosperity gospel, toxic productivity dogma. I know this is a lot to throw at you, but because that was really a big pull for me with Nexium. It, you know, obviously meaning, community, that was the foundation, but then it also became about like being the best version of myself. And it was, you were never really allowed to stop. I mean, you could, but then you'd be shamed or punished. Like there was no vacation. Here's a thought terminating cliche. Why would you vacate from your life?
Oh, these are good,
right?
Oh man.
Right? I just remembered that once. I was always doing two or three things at once.
Mm-hmm. That's abusing language too.
Yeah.
100%.
But can you kind of give our audience like understanding what the toxic productivity dogma is, the prosperity gospel, how those two concepts relate?
Yeah, of course. So what we know as the American dream has evolved a little bit over the centuries, but the MLM industry is basically like this blown out, almost spoofed version of the American dream that ultimately derives from the same like Protestant ethic and the same workplace history as our regular dignified labor market. So in the book, I talk about the history of the Protestant ethic and how it evolved from Calvinism and even earlier to the values that we have as Americans working and trying to become our best selves and trying to ascend the corporate ladder, but also trying to strike out on our own as individualists, all of that that we know today. And yeah, I mean, the prosperity gospel is this idea that, you know, God helps those that help themselves. We have like so many phrases that we hear and use in our everyday lives that we don't even realize marry the idea of religion with the idea of money and finances and wealth, like the sacred stock market bell. And we even think of monetary blessings. It's such a strange thing to say like, oh yes, I'm blessed with this beautiful house. It's the idea that like God cares not only about your moral successes, but your financial successes. And that if you have achieved a certain level of wealth, that means that God loves you. And even if you are not a Christian, not a religious person at all, this value system has been deeply embedded. And so the prosperity gospel has evolved over time, but it's basically landed us in this place where we're in this almost toxically positive culture, where we truly believe that the American dream is accessible to anyone. If you just bootstrap and put your nose to the grindstone, oh, that phrase has a really terrifying origin, and work hard and believe in yourself, then you can achieve anything that you want to. Like life in America is a true meritocracy, and we're obsessed with these hierarchies and with ascending them. And, you know, we don't allow people to express misgivings. I mean, in MLMs, all of this is taken to an extreme. So Amway, which is the biggest multi-level marketing company in the world, they will put specific labels on negative thoughts. They'll call it stinking thinking. Like if you have stinking thinking, then you will not succeed in this business, which of course has been designed to fail. Like, you know, research shows that 99% of MLM recruits will never see a dime. But their form of gaslighting says that, like, this is a perfect system. The system will work no matter what. If you just put your nose to the grindstone and work really hard and believe in yourself, you will become a millionaire in a year. Literally mathematically impossible for everyone to do that. But, and then if you don't succeed, it's not the company's fault. It's your fault. You didn't try hard enough.
Yeah.
It's your fault.
Your fault. You were a stinking thinker. And they encourage you to cut stinking thinkers or anybody who expresses negativity about the company out of your life. So this toxic positivity rhetoric. Suppressives, exactly. The term taken from Scientology. So this toxic positivity, toxic productivity culture, this idea that if you succeed, you have earned it. And if you don't succeed, you deserve it, imbues so many spaces, not just groups we would think of as cults or MLMs or pyramid schemes, but our everyday workplaces. And that can be a real, it can be a real experience of gaslighting, because if the system is not a true meritocracy, and if the system is not set up to really help you ascend to the top, and therefore you haven't, and you'll truly believe that it's your fault and that you really don't have what it takes. And that really takes the blame away from the leaders at the top and on to the masses. And that can be really emotionally destructive. And in those times, we default to the authority figure who's telling us confidently what we need to do to be safe, what we need to do to be successful. That's what gaslighting is. When you feel so disoriented, either because you are financially unstable, or, you know, you don't feel like you have support on the outside, or because the very words, the very language that you've been speaking your entire life don't mean what you've always thought they've meant anymore, you're going to look to the nearest source of support and authority and comfort to tell you what you need to do to move forward. And that person in these cultish groups is going to be the leader at the top, and that person is not going to have your best interests in mind.
Which is why I'm so excited we're starting with this episode, because we're going to do deep dives on these other groups, especially like things like the yoga groups, with even my preliminary research.
anytime someone has a problem, the authority will say thought terminating cliches such as, well, you're not trusting the process.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems
that's
like
the worst. Mm-hmm.
That seems like ego. Is that your ego speaking?
Mm-hmm.
So there's, before we read your book, we had read something about the concept of a closed loop system of logic,
mm-hmm.
right? Which keeps people in the loop of the logic of that the cult created with the education that was laid out.
Exactly.
So, and it doesn't matter if it's yoga or Nexium or Scientology, if you're agreeing to that and agreeing to, because you're above me in this ranking system, I'm going to trust in you and trust that anytime I'm uncomfortable, I will go to you and you'll tell me what's right. That's problematic. Our team at A Little Bit Culty Podcasts loves the Blood Ties podcast because it is gritty and current and fascinating. It's also a little bit culty. Blood Ties, the award-winning audio drama from Wondery, returns for its third season, Strange Days, with another thrilling story about greed, power, and deception. 5 years have passed since Eleanor, played by Julian Jacobs of Community, took over as CEO of the infamous Richland family empire, alongside her half-brother, Santino, played by Christian Navarro of 13 Reasons Why. Together, they decide to invest the family fortune in a groundbreaking, controversial new drug. But as shocking revelations about the new treatment emerge, Eleanor and Santino go to every length to protect their control of the Richland family dynasty. As Eleanor's father always said, medicine is a bloody business. Listen to Blood Ties, Season 3, Strange Days, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Spotify, or you can binge the whole series now, early and ad-free, by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app.
Because you're not able to reference an outside source. Like, you can't skip rank.
You
can't
go outside. Source.
Like, the system of truths, that like universe of reality, has been established with language for you. So you can't go outside of it. And that is exactly what you're saying, really problematic. I mean, in terms of like the yoga groups and stuff, I open the book Cultish with a story from the Kundalini Yoga cult,
right.
The Happy Healthy Holy organization. This was the first interview that I did for the book, and it just like stayed at the top of it because it was so compelling. This story offered an example of one of these loaded words that was like a real English phrase that was slowly and deliberately twisted to mean something different in the context of the cult that forever made that ex-member shudder and also served to manipulate her while she was inside of it. And the phrase was old soul. So old soul to the rest of us is like compliment. It means someone who's wise beyond their years. But in the context of this Kundalini yoga group, it meant someone who'd reincarnated life after life after life after life and could never get it right. So it was used as a threat. It went from a compliment to a threat. Now everything that you did, if you were going to disobey the rules, that was lingering over your head. You're going to be an old soul. You're not going to become enlightened. You're going to be lizard brain, Piscean consciousness. Like, these words sound so ridiculous to outsiders, but they were really used as a form of control and gaslighting and real violence at the end of the day.
Wow.
Are we at the ass-chapping part of our segment?
Do you know about our ass-chapping part of segment? Do you know about that in our podcast?
No, I don't. Wait, remind me.
We have a segment on our show of What Chaps My Ass.
So yeah, generally with our guests, we ask them like, how did you get in? How did you get out? And how are you healing? And then also if they would share something that chapped their ass about the cult that they were in. And maybe, and I also try to find new and crazy things that happen in ours that chapped their ass. So since you weren't in one, I guess what we could ask you is, in your research, or like, I guess in just this whole where we are right now in the zeitgeist of pop culty culture stuff, what chaps your ass the most about what you've seen? Like, what's the most ass-chapping thing?
Well, yeah. I mean, no, I was not in a Nexium level cult. But again, my argument is that we're all a member of something that's at least cultish.
Yes.
And for me, it's definitely Instagram. I joke, but I mean this sincerely, that the algorithm is the ultimate cult leader, sending us down rabbit holes that just encourage us to believe more and more extreme versions of what we already do.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that has been chapping my ass the worst on social media recently is the emergence of mental health influencers, like people who either do have a license in psychotherapy or don't, who are taking advantage of the extreme mental health vulnerability that exists in our culture right now with the pandemic and so much political divisiveness and so little access to affordable therapy. And now, you know, since COVID, physical access to therapy, people are taking advantage of that by providing, you know, really seemingly digestible, graphically designed nuggets of Instagram mental health wisdom that seem to resonate with everybody who comes across them because they're like horoscopes. It's like so vague that anybody can see themselves in it. And a lot of these mental health influencers who've gained huge followings because so many people are seeking mental health healing during these times will, you know, offer sort of like debated, if not full-blown quack mental health advice, always on like a beautiful pastel background with like pretty sans serif font. And then they'll encourage you to like buy their book and then their course and then attend one of their retreats and then become a part of their Facebook group. And then all of a sudden you have not left your home, but you're a part of this sort of like quack mental health cult where you are worshiping the singular and probably discredited ideology of this one person who is not your therapist. They don't even know you exist because there are millions of you, but they care about their own money and clout as any influencer would. And yet the stakes are not like, I'm selling you a pair of leggings or I'm selling you an eye cream. It's like, I'm selling you your own mind, your own sanity. And the danger of that has been chapping my ass downright raw lately.
Well, that as is it such should. A good I mean, one. We had a guest on who basically, I think, fell prey to an algorithm and indoctrinated themselves through YouTube videos.
Into white supremacy.
Yeah. And just hearing her story was, oof. And that's what QAnon basically is. It's a Q drop.
It's chilling. It's chilling.
Follow that. And that's.
Exactly. Exactly.
That's pretty nuts.
And a lot of these like alternative, I'm sure you've heard the word conspiritualist type of influencers can be an on-ramp to that much more dangerous right. QAnon type thinking and action, you know? And we, you know, at the very, very beginning of the interview, you mentioned the word rubbernecking. And this is what I talk about like super early on in the book. It's like, why are we interested in this stuff? Like, why are people who have seemingly never been in a cult or whatever, like, why are we so interested in why, you know, you're like perfectly sweet yoga mom down the street is now in QAnon, or like how your best friend from high school is now like balls deep in an MLM or whatever it is. It's because like, why are we interested in that stuff? And it's because we are secretly scanning for threats, or not secretly, unconsciously. Yeah. Like when we see not only something like a car crash, but even news of a car crash or another disaster, a cult disaster, even in something like a headline or a social media post, you know, our brains send off those fight or flight signals because we want to know whether or not this thing is a threat to us. Like, is this cult a danger to us? And the answer is like, kind of, mm-hmm. kind of. We're all susceptible to this type of influence to some degree. Some people more than others for whatever reason,
or their different times
background,
in their life.
Yeah. Their brain, of course. Yeah. But we are all susceptible to this type of thinking. And it's important to be aware of the language that's being used to influence you, because it can help you decide whether or not you want to continue engaging with right. the group that's using it. And if so, to what extent.
That's really ultimately the goal for our podcast too. We're not walking around saying you're in a cult, that's a cult, that's not a cult. We want people to understand the processes,
the precursors,
and what the groups use so they can spot it. And specifically, obviously this episode is about language. And why we think your book is great and probably like the definitive book about cults in terms of what's happening right now. Like all the other cult books they're great, but they're dated. Yeah, you sure. have like what's happened in the past like year is the most relevant for me anyway, a year or two, you know, especially with QAnon. And I remember like this time last year, I was just learning about it and I'm trying to figure out what it was and put the pieces together. And we'll do a deep dive somewhere in season two. But I think it's the most current. And if people want to know more, obviously they will. But I have to get my... I hope they'll read it, but I want to get my chaps my ass in. Is this a good time?
Yeah, I mean, this is the part of our show.
Okay, so I want to relate it to one of the things I learned in your book, which was, you know, we've joked about, oh yeah, CrossFit, I've never taken CrossFit, but it seemed culty just because it was so insular, which is, you know, one of the mm-hmm. things. But as I was reading your book, I had a friend and neighbor say that they wanted to get into fitness again, and they're thinking about joining CrossFit. And I was like, don't do that. and she knows my story, and she's listened to the podcast. I'm like, it's a little bit culty. And she's like, oh, but why? And I was able to pinpoint specifically why it's culty in terms of the language. And I love that there was that one of your instructors was named Flex, real name Adam. It just made me laugh so hard.
I love that.
Flex. I'm going to go to Flex's class. That could be your name. He loves to flex in the mirror. But
whoa.
I'm learning so much about you.
No. You don't get to do that.
Yeah, loves ice, loves flexing.
He's a special, live special your best creature. Live it, babe. But also specifically that they shame people for not attending class or shun them when they leave. And right. and the thing that really resonated, again, gave me a aha about our group, is that there's that concept of like the badge of honor of pushing yourself to the limit. Like, yeah, I tore my MCL. I'm so badass. Like, and that's to injure yourself in CrossFit is like a proof of how hardcore you are. And
exactly, and
that was like, well, fuck, because I remembered, and this is what chaps my ass, is that people really wore their hardcoreness on their as a badge of honor. Next team of like, I only slept 2 hours last night. Like, because Keith would always purport that like we don't need as much sleep as we think we do, and that's a limiting belief to think you need 8 hours, because you really don't, and you're just wasting your life if you're sleeping that much.
That's the toxic productivity,
right?
And you're so right about that. Like in CrossFit, they have literal mascots called Pukey, which is like puking or even like peeing on the floor because you've been working out so hard, is exactly like you're saying, a badge of honor. People even enter like kidney failure because they're working out way too hard in CrossFit, and there's a mascot for that too. But it reminds me of too, like in Scientology, there were all these wacko things that they would do with language. L. Ron Hubbard was a real visionary with the cultish language stuff.
Visionary.
But yes, if you want to put it that way. He was just a freaking sci-fi nerd who took it way too far. But anyway, I remember there was this one, my Scientology source told me this story about how there was a course called Key to Life. Think about how loaded that sounds. But it was literally just, how to explain this briefly, the most mind-numbingly boring course, where you would like go through a Scientology text and make sure that you understood all of the prepositions, articles, conjunctions, like all mm-hmm. the tiny little words in the text properly according to Scientology.
Yeah.
Mm. And I'm just like, and it was like exactly what you're saying, a badge of honor to have graduated from Key to Life because you had dedicated so much time and tediousness to the group.
I think they would have lost me there because I'm so bad at stuff like that. That would have been my out.
I'm
dyslexic. You would have been like, grammar? I don't know. Yeah. No, you're safe from Scientology then, I think.
Yeah, I think I'm safe from a lot of things. But I think also what helped me kind of pull myself together in reading your book, and why it was profound for me, is that I've been a little bit like, what am I now? Like what people have said to me, like, what do you do now? I'm like, well, I do a little bit of yoga, but I'm not part of a yoga community. You know, I drink my celery juice, but I'm not selling it. You know, I meditate a little bit, but I'm not part of a group. I think staying away from groups in general probably be big part of like the rest of my life.
I'm very, very skeptical.
We also have kids. So like, yeah, what are we going to do? But what was the word you use? Like the mismatch, mix and match?
This is a Tara Isabella Burton word. The remix.
Yes,
religiously remixed.
I'm going to remix, and I'm okay with that. And I'm remixing, and I'm taking from here and there. And I love what you said about like when you come home and you're like, you're still yourself and you're not all in on anything. And I think what I got from the book, and I don't want to give away the ending for our readers, but for me is like not feeling bad about my quest for meaning and my quest for community. And, you know, I've been pretty like open about that from the beginning. Like people always say, well, what were you going for? What did you think you were getting into? And I've used the word community, and Nippy has been like, what did you say about the community?
I mean, I didn't really like that many people in it.
So he didn't really like the community,
but it was 10 people I liked.
It was more for you about the community of people you thought were in line with your values.
That's what we're doing.
Yeah. So
the sense of purpose.
And not feeling alone in that. And I really loved just how you, you know, your journey in understanding this stuff laid it out for people that that's okay to like, well, you want to wrap up your own book in your own words. But I wanted to really thank you for that because it made me feel less alone. It made me feel not judged. It made me feel like, yeah, this is a crazy world. We're all lost sometimes. And there's nothing wrong with that. So thank you.
Totally. We are all lost. Like, this is a really confounding, overwhelming, existentially crushing, but also really inspiring universe. And it's like the oldest thing in human existence to want to learn, like, why am I here? Like, what is my purpose? How can I spend these few years I have on this fucking flying rock? And sometimes we want to participate in something a little bit culty in order to find those answers. And that is not necessarily bad. When someone at the top takes advantage of those profoundly human cravings, that's bad. But as long as we can be aware of what that might look and sound like, then of course we can participate things that are a little cultish here and there in an attempt to, yeah, like fill a hole or find what we're looking for. And maybe we never will, but it's worth it to try.
Or explore your curiosity.
Yeah. It's important to be curious too and not be too cynical. And there's a fine balance
there. Oh, completely.
Like a little cynical, but a little curious.
If my dad were too cynical, he would have never become who he is.
Can you tell us, Amanda, like some of the things for our listeners where they can find more of you, your Instagram, your book, your podcast, all that stuff?
Sure. Yes. Right. If you would like to join my little mini cult, you can find both of my books, Cultish and Word Slut is my first book, wherever books are sold in, you know, physical copy, ebook, audiobook, whatever you want. You can find me on Instagram at Amanda_Montel. And then I also have a podcast that just wrapped up its first season called Sounds Like a Cult, available wherever you get your pods.
Awesome.
I'm going to be one of your followers now.
Yeah. We so appreciate your time, Amanda. This is like,
thank you, Amanda.
I'm so glad we had the extra week to prepare because there's just so much in your book that's so juicy. I mean, we could really talk for hours.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I've been really looking forward to this and I really admire you both so much. And yeah, I'm just really excited about it. And I'm sure that readers of Cultish will just like freak out. Actually, one of my close friends is like an absolute stan of your podcast. And when I told them that I was going to be doing this, they like flipped a lid. So people in my world are going to lose it.
Oh, goody. Well, consider us followers. We'll be senior coaches in your group.
Likewise.
That was great, Sarah.
I really didn't want to let her get off the phone.
I could party with Amanda. I could sneak out at 10 p.m. and go drink and smoke a joint with her.
I would too. Maybe we'll do that when we go to Silver Lake. I'm so glad she wrote this book. I really do feel like it's the definitive current book for what's happening in the cultiverse.
Than the traditional, somewhat more academic ones that we've been reading, so... Kudos to Amanda Montel.
Yes. Kudos to Amanda Montel and excited to give one of her books away and do an Instagram live with her and just abuse this social media cult that we have to be a part of.
Seriously.
To get our word out. What do you want to do now? Yoga class? Green juice?
I'm going to do some CrossFit.
So thanks everybody for joining us. And if you want to be a really good student and get that gold star or the next stripe on your sash, you can watch Lula Rich on Amazon. And I would also recommend downloading on Audible or reading Cultish, which we've just been talking about, because both of those things will give you an incredible foundation for our conversation with Roberta Blevins, one of the whistleblowers on the MLM legging scandal that is rocking the nation.
A legging scandal.
It's a dangerous cult.
Oh, yeah.
When you get leggings involved. See us next week.
Next week.
Bye for now. Sinking down to the depths of the ocean.
Let's keep the conversation going. We'll be back soon with more episodes of A Little Bit Culty with more experts and survivors. And sometimes experts who are survivors, as well as some familiar faces from The Vow from HBO.
If you've got suggestions or questions on upcoming topics, find us on Instagram at A Little Bit Culty.
And for more background on what brought me here, my memoir, Scarred, The True Story of How I Escaped Nexium, the Cult That Bound My Life, is available on Amazon, Audible, and where most books are sold.
If you'd like to help us spread the word about A Little Bit Culty podcast, please give us a 5-star review and tell your friends to subscribe.
Seriously, like, take out their phone and tell them to press subscribe. It takes a second. We're also available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and every major listening app. And if you're listening on a smartphone, tap or swipe over the cover art of this podcast to find show notes and helpful resources.
You might also find some offers from our sponsors there. And when you support our sponsors, you help us keep this podcast going. Just don't be a little bit culty about it.
A Little Bit Culty is executive produced by me, your co-host, Sarah Edmondson, and Anthony Nippy Ames.
That's me.
Associate producer is Jess Tardy. Produced, edited, mixed, and mastered by Citizens of Sound. Our amazing theme song, Cultivated, is by John Bryant and co-written by Nigel Asselin. I'm Sarah Edmondson, and thanks for listening to A Little Bit Culty.